Hopefully this is recording. Today is January 14th, 2014. Dr. Floyd O'Neill will be talking to Geography 2600, Geography, Yoga, and Place, about the evolving view of the West through American history. Please sit down. I'll show you what other stuff we have. It's great. And leave that. And let me work. I'll do some course logistics.
Okay.
Here's basically the plan.
Okay.
Like that. And so don't feel you have to take a full hour. I'd love it if you did. You can take more than that. And then what we're going to do is they have watched a PBS special on, or some of them have, on Willa Cather. It basically talks about her role. And we'll be talking about that with respect to the context of history and how it
and
fit
I'll
and didn't
hit. I'll
have a
little to say about it in my lecture.
Oh, I'm so pleased. And then we'll be actually perhaps talking about Stegner in a sense of place. And then Anne Holman, what she'll do is we'll talk about different books. Because although our numbers are small, our ambitions are great. And we'll talk about what aspects of history we really want to explore, whatever. You may be long gone by then.
Okay.
But so let me share with them what we have. So here's the plan. Dr. Elaine Backus. She's been a professor at Westminster. And at Westminster, she was fascinated by the imaging, basically she would call it construction, of the West in films. She's not only interested in the construction of the West in films, she's interested in what it does to us. And that's, Cheryl, where I have learned about how fascinated I am with this topic. And I'm absolutely just going to do it, even if nobody shows up here. Dr. Backus and I and Emily will talk to each other, and Anne if she'll come, and Jeff if he will come, because this idea that everything is a construction. And I would say, no, not earth science that I do. But if you recall, I showed those two maps last time, the one with the north of the globe showing north here and then sort of the Australian's view. That's so funny, but you say to yourself, that map has sort of its own take on the world, and it's a construction. So everything's a construction, as geographers say. The earth is round, every map lies. And it does. So what we're going to do today is we're going to explore a major discipline of the humanities, namely history. But we're going to be exploring it from this take of a sense of place, or construction of the West. And I was able to take Dr. O'Neill's, well, I just sat in on it. He is generous, of Geography of Utah. And I don't know whether you remember that little quip you say at the beginning, that it was taught by two people but different courses. What was that? This idea that your view of Geography of Utah, or whatever, also is a construction. This idea that construction surrounds us. So we're exploring the humanities. So just reviewing what the course is doing. First, we're just going parallel tracks. We're just doing what everyone else would do in a non-interdisciplinary course. We're just going to do the humanities, boom, 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 boom. We've done a bit about literature, we're gonna do history, we're gonna do ethics, we're gonna do mythology. And then boom, 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 we're gonna do the physical sciences, the geosphere, the hydrosphere, the weather and climate. But then, by gosh, we're going to explore this. We're going to look at a novel, your novel that you have chosen, And with such a small group, we can do anything we like, okay? But my sense is, by next week, you should have chosen a novel set in the American West. Hello, come on in. Oh gosh, how could I, with so few people, how could I forget? Tell me your name again.
Kelsey.
Kelsey, okay, this is great. Kelsey, this is Dr. O'Neill from the History Department, and I'm just reviewing, what are we doing here? And Kelsey, we're doing anything we want, because we're such a small group, okay? Bottom line is, what's neat about, I think, this course, and what has taken on such meaning to me, is that it is interdisciplinary. We're first doing the one parallel track of humanities, today's history. And we're exploring sense of place, perception of place from history. In a while, we're going to do the sciences, geosphere, etc. We're going to do geography. You're going to love it. I know you already love it because you're a geography major, but don't be threatened. We're going to learn Google Earth. We're going to learn some skills. We're going to just do sort of, it's not, 101 isn't fair, but getting some basic skills of geographers is part of our mission. Then, we're going to put the two together. We're going to put them together with the book. So by the end of today, Anne Holman is going to be sort of poking around on what do you really want as a book. And the homework by next week is that you are going to have decided on your novel set in the American West, and you're going to be using those tags, I didn't bring a set of tags this time, sort of saying, you know, where does location fit in this? Where does topography and landscape fit in this? Where does hydrology fit in this? You'll be reading your book, sort of just marking where the author has set the novel. And then we're going to examine how that setting, just the way Willa Cather, you know, looked at her world. What was she really trying to construct? Not that we know what an author was doing, so let's say it differently. What's the construction that the novel gives to the West? And we'll be tying that to some movies. So it's sometimes easier with the film. So bottom line is, easy rider, when it's freedom, you are in the Colorado Plateau. And when it is vipers and wickedness, you are in the South. And that's one of the things we'll actually explore, is the power of place with respect to stereotyping of regions, as well as the power of place that a Terry Tempest Williams would have, which is a groundedness. So after all that, I want to turn it over to Dr. O'Neill, whom I'm grateful to be here. We all okay? Everybody's sort of set up with the program? Okay, I'm going to shut the door. And does everybody know everybody? Jeff Scott. And I do yoga at the Alba Club. In the card room. Now, if you know the Alba Club, there were places women weren't allowed to go. Most of the place. Now, I grew up with the Alba Club. In fact, it's probably my sense of place. And but even when I was made the first woman at the Alba Club, Sam Arntz, who had the biggest set of teeth I've ever seen in anybody's mouth, okay, he didn't even tell me that I wasn't allowed in the card room. But he did tell the next three people. They weren't allowed in the card room. The card room is the sanctum of sanctum, and it now, on Fridays, is where we do yoga. There is something shocking about how times have changed. So I was bemoaning last Friday, saying, oh, they're going to cancel this class. I just need one more person. Just, you know, what do they say about the Marines? One more good man or woman. And Jeff said, I'll take it. And Jeff has actually been on the CSBS, College of Behavior and Social Sciences board. And so here he is, and he may recruit another. Because I think the topic is fascinating. I think to look at the power of place that surrounds us, from the advertising of the Travel Council, we are so manipulated. But maybe I've said enough. Okay, so Jeff Scott, Anne Holman, Cheryl
Underwood,
Emily Pfeiffer,
Kelsey Howard,
Sean O'Neill, Floyd O'Neill, Genevieve Allen. Okay, I'll zip it up now. Totally. Okay. Got
it. It's nice to be with you. Let me begin by saying that My field of history was American Indian history, and it is what I taught most in the university, only for 34 years, but that's beside the point. It's not how long you teach, it's how well. The American West, wherever you go, you must always think of the sense of place as the American Indians might have thought of it. And I'll come back to that in a moment. There were more than 200 tribes or sub-tribes west of the Mississippi. The languages, those in Louisiana, were as different from those in Washington State as Turkish is from Norwegian. They were different cultures. In my years of working on Indian reservations, and it was only about 26, the challenge was always to try and see the way they saw. And one of the things that then and now that they were most interested in was place. It's still true. If you don't believe it, go and look at the number of lawsuits filed over land. Very quickly after the United States became an entity, we acquired the Louisiana Purchase. And the Louisiana Purchase doubled the size of the nation. Now, it is said that we bought the Louisiana Purchase for 3 cents an acre. We didn't buy a damn thing. All we bought was French interests, and they did not claim to sell us the land. And lawsuits simply have, since that time, have recognized that. The French were more sensitive to Indian claims than the English-speaking. Our ancestors may have been a little bit thick. The exploration of that vast territory was interesting too, because the French had explored the territory beginning in the 1680s, and it had gone from there. Furthermore, by the time of our establishment, I'd remind you that there were French settlements in Wisconsin, 4 in Illinois, 1 at St. Louis, or St. Louis as we now call it, at Cape Girardeau in the south of Missouri, and ultimately New Orleans. The French had a difficult time militarily with the British and lost out, but they were important in the West. Why? Because the French were more able to deal with the tribes on an equal basis and avoid war far more than the English speaking. And therefore, the fur trade was much more successful among the French than among the English. And as they penetrated from the Hudson Bay all the way to the Pacific coast, it was the French who were able to carry the burden of the trade. It was they who founded the first settlement in Utah, called Fort Robideau. Interesting enough, Antoine Robideau and his brothers. And so it would be wrong of us to forget that important role and their ability to penetrate the area and describe the land. The first persons from Europe to see the Rocky Mountains were the brothers La Vérendrye, who were from Quebec, and so on. It goes on. The Hispanic West was very early. Not only did Spain come to the New World and expand rapidly, They were able to hang on to it for a very long time. The land was theirs. They began in Mexico around 1500, and by a century later, they had penetrated with settlements as far north as Santa Fe, New Mexico, founded in 1608. Remember Jamestown, the first English colony, 1607. So that you had them penetrating 600 miles inland a year after Jamestown. Furthermore, they were able to hang on to it except for 12 years during an Indian rebellion. Furthermore, they're still there. All you have to do is go to New Mexico, and there they are. It's interesting, too, about the Hispanic West. In the Hispanic West, there were three areas of settlement. One was New Mexico, and then at the time of the American Revolution, an expansion up into California. It's very interesting to visit California and visit the missions that were founded there. The one in the north was San Francisco in 1776. Therefore, the Spanish influence in California, you can't drive through the place without inquiring dozens of Spanish names. The Indian tribes there did not have a good time of it. Well, they didn't have a good time any place, come to think of it. But the Pueblos were more... The missions in California were more remote, not as closely managed. And therefore, there was some exploitation of the American Indians that didn't take any... it was not well done. It was very well done compared to what happened to them when the English-speaking arrived. The third area was southern Arizona. If you are ever in Tucson, drive 3 miles south and look at the magnificent old church founded by Father Kino, an Austrian working for Spain, and a Spanish padre, and that wonderful church founded in 1703. There is an older West than those of us who are juvenile. Think of the West that way. And Father Kino's spectacular success in the area, more of it in Mexico on the north at Caborca and other places than in the two major areas in the United States, one at San Javier del Bac and the other one just to the south of it. It's interesting when I look back at it. I remember about, my goodness, can it be 65 years ago, I had a wonderful time reading Willa Cather's Death Comes for the Archbishop. It was interesting because when I went to New Mexico, I was ill-prepared to see and feel the emotion that I felt having read her novel in going to those places. Here was the story of a man who came there. What happened was that it had always had Spanish prelates in the archbishopric at Santa Fe. It was a small bishopric, non-suffering. Do you all know what non-suffering? There were no bishops under him. He was an archbishop standing alone. And then the United States seized the area in the war. And that meant that the Catholic heritage was transferred from Mexico City to Baltimore, which was then the head of the Catholic Church in America. And so you had French priests in Baltimore, French archbishops, appointing someone in New Mexico, which was now U.S. territory, and so you send in a Frenchman. Oh my gosh. Can you imagine the surprise in New Mexico? Not only that, he was such an influence. It's not just that he built a French-looking cathedral, or got it partly built, it's never been finished, in downtown Santa Fe. But he introduced the new foods. A wonderful, wonderful story in the founding of Bishop's Lodge. And going, I spent 12 years as a consulting historian for the 19 pueblos of New Mexico. And going to the little chapel that he prayed in, a sense of place. And then the Americans discovered lately how to be discoverers. And, you know, I've had a bit of trouble in Lewis and Clark's expedition. It's absolutely central in American history. Everybody touts Lewis and Clark. Hell, the French Canadians were on the Pacific coast 12 years earlier. Furthermore, the journals are worshipped. And I have questions, especially on the mountain area. Here was a woman who was Shoshonean, who led them carrying her baby across the top and was the interpreter. And they tell me what she said. Well, when I think of it, here was Sacagawea speaking in Shoshone, translating it into Sioux for her French husband, whose name was Toussaint Charbonneau, who translated it into French for Meriwether Lewis, who translated it into English for Clark. I'm not so sure you can do that many translations, and there's a problem. I disagree with some of my colleagues as to the veracity. Oh well, that's too individual, isn't it? It's very interesting about American expansion. The expansion into the Mississippi Valley was a hesitating kind of a thing because Jefferson claimed not to be interested in expansion. But he sure as hell spent a lot of time looking at the gold mines of Mexico. I wonder. At any rate, it was with the Mexican War that things really expanded into our area, and we are on land that was once Mexican, and before that Spanish. North of us, along the Idaho border and north, it was conceded to us in 1819 by the British. It was interesting. We were such modest folks in this country. What did we claim was ours? 5440 or fight. That meant Juneau. Good Lord. Now there's a jump. And we claimed Washington Territory, what is now Washington State and Oregon. How many people did we have there? Well, we had one failed colony, probably 20 trappers. They had four forts and about 200 people and 25 years experience, but it was ours. And to avoid war, as the Canadians put it, Britain's needs were Canada's sacrifices. And so we acquired along the 49th parallel. My goodness, what a treasure. Only 30 years later, we had expanded all the way to California with the Mexican War. I must tell you a story about teaching in the room next door a history of the American West. I had six French immigrant students, and we talked about the Mexican War and James K. Polk. And after the class, they came to me and they said, "Did he really push back the borders that far?" I said, "Yes." "Then why is there not a statue in every Western city to James K. Polk?" I said, "Well, we're not too proud of the way he did it." And they said, "That wouldn't be an argument in Europe. That wouldn't be an argument. When Louis XIV pushed back the borders, to hell with everybody else." Went on for about another 2 weeks, and they came to again, now try and tell us why there is no praise for James K. Polk, your great expansionist." My goodness. Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, California, some of Wyoming, part of Colorado, a little of Oklahoma. Now that's an expansion. Well, in the midst of all of this acquisition of land, you also have the movement west. Talk about place. People were searching for place. Most of them were from Great Britain, where land was largely owned by the gentry and the nobility, and their hunger for land was absolutely astonishing. So was it from the poor from Eastern United States. And so you have people seeking a place. And therefore, the trails across to California before and after the Mexican War are just amazing. The same is true in Texas. The land was available. It was so ingrained. My French grandfather never sold land. "If you sell land, you'll die poor." Doesn't it sound European? Well, I've sold land. It's all right. We're part of the West. The Oregon Trail had opened, and the California Trail was in the beginning of being opened. One of the first of the big groups was the Donner Trail through Salt Lake City the year before the Mormons. There are several myths about that that trail across the United States. Several historians have now looked carefully at the various wagon trains crossing. How many of the people who crossed from Missouri to California died at the hands of Indians? They estimate 1 in 2,000. The history of violence along that trail is absolute bunk. Mm-hmm. It just is not true. They might have had problem with the prairie tribes, but they thought of them as people who were going somewhere else. And as long as they were going somewhere else, that's just fine. And the way they lived, the way the things they carried, the way the things they abandoned, they were a bit of a shock to the tribes. But the violence did not break out until the occupation of those lands and the killing of game. The gold rush, oh boy. The Mormons had come 2 years before the gold rush. They were here and they took advantage of the gold rush. People would wear out their teams along the trail, and the Mormons would take fresh horses north along the Idaho border and sell them and bring the worn out horses down into Cache Valley and the Brigham City area and as far south as Salt Lake, restore them, take them back and trade them. It worked. They also brought other things. And so it was interesting too how quickly we responded to California with its gold. Oh boy. When did we acquire it? In the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. How soon did it become a state? Less than 2 years. 1850. I find it interesting that the political move was so quick, followed by Oregon by only a few years. There was a political determination to occupy the West. We refer to it in history as manifest destiny. A newspaper and some damn Irishman named O'Sullivan said that it was manifestly our destiny to occupy all of the West, ocean to ocean, if not all of North America. Modesty reigns again. California expansion was absolutely startling. Many people who came and failed at finding gold, but left other things. If you go and buy a bottle of Paul Masson wine, a gold rusher from France who couldn't make a go at gold, so he planted grapes and got rich anyway. And then there were the Mormons. There are so many anomalies about the occupation of this place. Oh my. In reading carefully what Brigham Young, their leader, had to say, I have never read anyone who was more convinced of Jeffersonian agrarianism than Brigham Young. Everybody had to be farmers. You were in trouble if you tried to be a miner. It was interesting. The problem was, they put their roots down in the damnedest place to try and farm. You look at Utah from the air sometime as you fly over. Never in the history, from 1847 until now, have we ever had 3% of the state under agriculture. Never. You can't really find verdant wheat fields if you drive from Price to Monticello. is just plain not there. Now, I can admire the Mormons endlessly for how they struggled. I remember one time going to Bluff, Utah, which was one of the late settlements, and I was talking to one of the men there and looking at the abandoned homes and the people who had moved away, and I said, "It's bewildering to me why they would do it." He reacted angrily and he said, "God sent our families. What the hell are you doing here?" Well, it was a good time to leave. The Mormons attempted a lot of expansion as well, founding such places as San Bernardino in California and Las Vegas Settlement. Can you imagine farming at Las Vegas? Now that would take an act of God. And then there was the mining west. Not just the gold mines of California, but the riches of the Montana mines, the Colorado mines, and the latecomers in the Utah mines. I find it interesting in teaching Utah history. If you go back and look at the census of 1900, there were about 11 millionaires in Utah. One was Mormon, and the rest of them were associated with the mining industry. And so a bunch of Irishmen came with crazy names like the Kearns and so on. And they were Catholic. Their remnants are still here, like the Cathedral of the Madeleine on South Temple, the second largest religion in Utah. I don't know whether that's good or bad, because the Mormons and the Catholics both have very high birth rates, and we have an avalanche of kids and problems with funding education. Well, maybe God sent them. I'll shut up. The mines were particularly interesting because they attracted new people. And the new people were from everywhere, just like the gold rush. The mines of Montana, when you think of Butte and Anaconda and Helena, or if you think of Nevada with the great mines in and around Reno, still a huge industry, especially in the mining of gold in the north. And then Utah. How long has the Kennecott mine operated in Utah? It and its predecessors, the Utah Copper and so on. Well, 130 years. I'll talk about environmentalism in a few minutes. Am I taking too long? Anyway, the mines were remarkable. And they enriched the nation. So much so that they influenced politics very, very trenchantly by the turn of the century, with William Jennings Bryan trying to get the coinage of silver raised to raise the prosperity of the West. Hell of an idea in an international idea, but whatever. The mines were closely associated with something else. Not just the Civil War, because the financing of the Civil War depended on a good deal of what was produced by the mines and shipped east. There was transportation. Now there was going on in that time, at the time of the Civil War, a couple of things. The most strident of all of the advocates of the West was Abraham Lincoln. What did he sponsor? A transcontinental railroad. Probably long before it should have been built. The railroad bill was passed in his administration, and for heaven's sakes, 4 years after his assassination, you have the rails joined at Promontory, Utah. Isn't that interesting? How long did it take to make the railroad successful? A while. But the government kept pouring money into it. It may have been early, but it was profound in its effect. And the effect meant that there were railroads across the North. James J. Hill and his group building another railroad from Minneapolis to Seattle. And the Southern, the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. My goodness. Building a railroad to Southern California? Well, yes, people came. The transportation frontier that is often forgotten in the West is the number of ships that went around the Horn and came up the West Side in that huge long journey. And then there was another transportation that I've always found amazing. And that was that there was a huge leather industry, leather coats and shoes, in the Connecticut River Valley in western Massachusetts. It was the center of that manufacture from about 1830 till 1970. In the Reagan administration, since then, shoes have been made everywhere else but here. But why did it happen? There were huge herds of cattle in California. The amount of leather you could gain, so they would shoot as many as 1,000 head of cattle, take their hides, and leave the bodies to rot. They needed the leather. Dump the leather before it was cured onto boats. And the claim was you could smell the damn things for 5 miles. But they went around the Horn and back up to New Bedford and other places to unload these stinking hides, which were then converted into shoes. We were still wearing them until a few years ago. But we weren't shipping hides that way, thank God. Probably the greatest giveaway of the Civil War was the Homestead Act. The Homestead Act was sponsored by Lincoln. Remember that he was from a frontier community in Illinois. And westward expansion was very much a part of his, not expansion in territory, but expansion in economy in the West was very much a part of his thing. And it was his idea that we needed a good number more residents on the Great Plains and west of there. So not only the railroad, but the farms. Well, two things changed the Great Plains. One was the invention of a steel moldboard plow. The moldboard meaning that part of the plow as you plow that turns the soil over. That meant that you could dig up if you had a 12-horse team. Imagine 12 horses to try and turn over that heavy sod. Well, that helped. But there was another thing that happened. Some people from southern Russia came to the Great Plains and they brought with them a bushel of wheat to plant. And to the amazement of the English-speaking people and the French who were there in the Mississippi Valley, what they did was they planted the wheat in the fall. By the next spring, it came up, it survived, and it yielded better than the wheat that they had. Furthermore, it was harder wheat and made better flour, stored longer. And the expansion in Russian wheat I find it interesting. What's America's greatest export right now? Food. In dollars, no other item equals our export. A lot of it is based upon the beginning with one bushel of wheat. Well, I'm dwelling too long, perhaps. The West also had another area because west of the 100th meridian, that is, west of Kansas and Nebraska and so on, mountainous area is a challenge to agriculture, and we developed herding. It had already been developed in Texas, and the Texans we know about the Chisholm Trail and so on, driving the herds north to Dodge City and so on, where they could be shipped east. But the herding in the West became central. And the amount of herding in Utah and other places was very great. And the competition for that was very great. So much so that the West was terribly overgrazed by the 1920s. It recovered some after the intervention by the federal government under Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s, and we're better now than we were, but not great. I find herding to be another thing. The herdsman, the only place in the world I've ever known about it, we called them cowboys, and they became the subject of our romances. Yeah, there were some of them who were wild, like the Wild Bunch and Butch Cassidy, who was a Mormon boy from Beaver, Utah, who was raised at Circleville and decided there was a better life. And oh, hell. If you want to read a book about it, a book published by the University of Nebraska called The Wild Bunch at Robber's Roost by Pearl Baker of Green River, Utah. What a bunch. So we romanticize crime. Go look at Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. By the way, Pearl Baker's nephew was the close associate of Robert Redford on the film. Well, let me explode a couple of myths. Number one, the violence in the West was no greater. The crime rate was no greater than the states in the East, and sometimes lower. There were not a lot of vigilante deaths, more than half of them in Montana. And 40% of all the cowboys were black. You sure as hell wouldn't know that if you went to see the movies, would you? It's not there. Furthermore, they were underpaid, unwashed, often uneducated. And so the old Western phrase about describing somebody as horny as a lonesome cowboy was certainly part of their lonely lives. But let's don't go there. You're too young to hear about it. I want to turn to the Indian Wars. There were two states that how do I put it? That were the most destructive. One was Texas. The other was California. The number of Indians killed sometimes for sport in the gold rush was just amazing. And when you read books like Ishi, The Last of His Tribe, you can tell the sadness that overcame these poor folk who were in the way. I remember being assigned by the National Endowment for the Humanities to work with a school curriculum problem at Hoopa Valley in Northern California. And I was leaving there to go with one of the tribal members to the National Archives to research. And the chairman of the tribe said to me, "Will you please be sure to pay special attention to the records of Fort Gaston?" Well, I knew of Fort Gaston. It was a military post set up there in the north. And I said, "Is there any particular reason that you are stressing Gaston?" And he said, "Yes. Their major reason for being here was to protect us against the miners, not to protect the whites against us. And they intermarried, and we have a lot of descendants who were fortunate enough to marry the soldiers at Fort Gaston, and therefore were interested." Wow. Interesting world. There was some of that with the founding of Fort Duchesne in Utah in 1886. Because a good number of those people had been expelled from Colorado in the damnedest set of circumstances. Even bands that had nothing to do with any conflict with the United States were forced out of the area of Ouray, Colorado, and into Utah at gunpoint, out onto that desert in the south end of the Uinta Basin, where they died like flies. The records say that 3,000 were transferred. In 15 years, there were 1,200. We don't like to look at that too closely. Not pretty. The North Plains, the novels will tell us that's more romantic because the Sioux the Cheyenne, the Pawnee, the Winnebago. The Army had their hands full. And if you don't believe it, go and look at the history of Mr. Custer. In the South Plains, a man named Mackenzie so drove the Indian groups that one major group fled into Mexico. So he invaded Mexico to punish them. The number of Indian tribes in Texas you will not find great. And you will find more tribes extant in Southern California, where it was Spanish influence, than in Northern, where it was largely Anglo. I must tell you a story. I grew up at Uinta Ouray in northeastern Utah until I was 15. When I was a lad, one of our colleagues was thrown from his horse and was killed, a 15-year-old lad. And we were at his parents had converted to Mormonism. And we were in the funeral, and there was a Mormon hymn being sung. And the words of the hymn went, "We'll find that place which God for us prepared far away in the West." And the two Indian women sitting near me, young women, looked at each other and said, "Oh, really? Did God give it to them? We thought the gods had given it." Well, whatever. You can see that the sense of place meant something. Now, the sense of place in Utah meant that the largest band of Ute Indians anywhere in Colorado, New Mexico, or Utah was at Utah Lake. But as they got into war with the settlers and with the struggle over Draper area, where the elk and deer came in winter and the Indians would kill them, the Mormons converted to a pasture, so the Indians took part of the cattle, and that led to war. And the war escalated, and by the 1860s, they were removed at gunpoint to the Uinta Basin. It was interesting to look back at that and see it. Now, the West was occupied. I want to talk about the penalties of occupation. The triumphs are everywhere. One of them is this university. One of them is, they're all around us. What an opulent society. We eat well, we dress well, most of us have good medicine, driving around in automobiles, some of them too damn big. But there are a couple of things that have happened. The minorities were largely pushed aside. It's true in New Mexico. It's certainly true in California. When I visit with the tribes at Morongo or Pala or the other Indian reservations, you can see that they're ghettoized. Here and Colorado, and most places, they are forced onto poor lands and then told to farm. The General William Tecumseh Sherman once said, after the founding of a lot of reservations beginning in 1886, he said, An American Indian reservation is a plot of poor ground dwelt in by starving Indians and surrounded by thieves. Ah, yes. And then there is the environment. Now, I want to talk about the West and the environment for a minute, because this is a geography class. Each generation is made to feel increasingly guilty about it, especially with the inversion. The next 2 weeks, you're going to hear lots of whining and moaning and swearing, and I'll join. You know, I'll try to escape. Let me give you a couple of examples about the Utah environment. Number one, it is not new. When the Mormons founded Great Salt Lake City and exotic places like Session Settlement, now Bountiful, and Provo, the winters were one hell of a challenge. How do you keep warm and how do you build buildings? And so they cut down the trees. And the journals say that for miles up the side of the river, the trees had just left the mountains bare. It was so bad that the territorial legislature offered a large cash prize if anybody could find a vein of coal, even 18 inches wide and within 40 miles of Salt Lake City. Didn't happen till the railroad came and the opening of Coalville, and shortly after, the opening of the mines at Schofield and in Carbon County. The pressure was there. Another of the problems environmentally was that we changed the very nature of the Utah Lake. Probably no lake in the American West produced as much lake trout as the Utah Lake. Was absolutely wonderful. And until about 1905, there were fisheries on the north end of the lake, and lake trout was one of the cheapest meals you could buy in the restaurants. What happened? Well, some Englishman discovered a thing. His name was Crapper, by the way, and he discovered the flush toilet. And so everybody got a flush toilet, and they dumped the sewage into the lake. And as the trout died, people from Germany planted German carp. Well, it's a shallow lake, and the carp ate the green stuff off the bottom and turned the whole damn thing into a roily sewer. So that by 1920, it could be used for farming, but little else. The tragedy of Utah Lake was so great. I remember when Dr. Thompson and I were doing the editing the memoirs of a Utah governor named Calvin Rampton. We went to him and said, to restore the lake, why don't you get the legislature to buy the deep trenching machines to dig three huge trenches through the lake and let it restore? He laughed. He said, I'd like to see you get the legislature to do anything that dramatic. Well, whatever. It didn't get done. But the lake is symbolic of what happened. The other thing is that the 1920s You cannot imagine the disaster that occurred with the ability of the land to carry grazing. There were huge numbers of sheep herds. They were mainly centered with Scandinavian families in San Pete County and with Greek and Italian families in Emory and Carbon County. The overgrazing of the land was simply criminal. The whining and crying of people about the limitations on that came with the Roosevelt administration was simply remarkable. But the land has recovered some, not enough. Environmentalism seems to be everybody's baby. We have a long history that needs repairing. In closing, just let me observe a thing or two. In my career, I taught for 50 years. That's long enough to make up your mind about one or two things, even if you're slow in thought, as I sometimes am. Think about place and yourself. We all need an identity. I was told at Bluff, Utah, what the hell are you doing here? Well, I'm here because I was lucky enough to be here. We must be more attentive to the needs of the newer immigrants. We must tell ourselves that we will find out about the culture in which we live. And if you're in the university, you have the obligation to think and to contemplate. In my last few classes I taught in the university, I was frustrated as hell and scolded my class that the minute they got out of class, they plugged something in their damned ears and they said, well, what did you do different? I said, well, we sat down and sort of finished off our notes and contemplated what was there and tried to think about what would be on the final exam. Gee. Now I want to show you something about immigration. This right here is a, you can come up if you want to. This is the border of the United States and Mexico, just west of Tucson. Each red dot represents one person killed who died trying to get into the United States and choked to death in that godforsaken desert. They are that desperate to earn a living. If you want to know, there are 240 dots. Think about place. Think about how to handle it. Think about thinking. I've bored the hell out of you quite enough, and we'll call that a good one for now.
I want more, but...
Well,
Do you want to leave, or would you? Can you entertain? Would you entertain some questions? Would you rather leave, or would you rather? I mean, you're wonderful to come. Would you entertain some questions? Or
I'll take questions now if anyone has them, and then I'll leave and go to dinner. No questions?
I'm a man of many questions.
All right.
You know, just a quick. You know, so Louisiana Purchase was what year?
1803.
Okay. Yeah, so there was
and it was Napoleon's needs that led mainly to the sale of it, and the rebellion in Jamaica, and they couldn't handle it, and so.
Right, and then question two. Now I know. So there's. I can read you to break or something. There, how many native Utah tribes are there?
How many?
Yeah.
Five major.
And they would be?
Ute, Uinta, Ouray.
Yeah.
Northwestern Shoshone,
okay.
Headquarters at Brigham City.
Yeah.
Three, Goshute,
okay.
Out on the west border.
Yeah.
Southern Paiute.
Right.
Headquarters at Cedar City now. Although most of their population was in Washington County. And then White Mesa Ute Paiute combination at White Mesa, Utah, south of Blanding.
Okay, so wait.
Then you have the Navajo.
Yeah.
And the Navajo are principally from the San Juan River south and in Montezuma Creek. And it is now true that we have one county that is predominantly Indian, and that's San Juan County.
Okay.
They have more Indians than white population.
Because that's predominantly Navajo.
Beg pardon?
That would be predominantly
Navajo. Yeah. Yes. Because the population at White Mesa is not large, but it's very historic and very interesting. And a recent book by a Utah author called As If the Land Owned Us, which is published by the U Press, is very descriptive of that area.
Mm.
Good questions. Any others? Yes.
This may be too large, but if you were just to look at newspaper articles or the equivalent and how they portrayed the West, I assume it would be different if it were from the East or from California, but can you just give us some insights with respect to that evolution, even up to today?
The newspapers were so varied. The mining town newspapers tended to be too localized to be important. Local interests tended to dominate. And then community newspapers, which existed in great numbers, were very often relied upon telegraph and so on, other than for very trivial things. The great newspapers of the West were published in California. The Alta Californian was one. The Deseret News from 1850 was published in Salt Lake City, was extremely pro-Mormon and Mormon-owned, as it still is, has been conservative. In all of its time, you can never find a liberal era. The Rocky Mountain News, which is no more, was an interesting one in that it tended to gather up the interests of a great deal of the West and talk about it. The Idaho Statesman, ho-hum. I think that was a criticism.
It hasn't changed.
The later pictures, like the Seattle Intelligencer, were good, but they looked more to the sea than they looked to the land. And so there is a variety. Now, if you do it generally, the Western papers had a few that were strong and that can be used very accurately by historians. East of the Mississippi, they were either condescending or romantic, much too often. And the condescension, the West grew faster, and therefore the transferring of an increasing number of people represented in the House of Representatives from the West, as they decreased the number in the East, of that 435 number, that meant that there was a good deal of resentment. The Southern newspapers, well, unless you've got a hell of a lot of time, don't go there. It's interesting to read them during the transition period from the Eisenhower administration through the administration of George H.W. Bush in terms of racism. Mm. That is very interesting. The number of opinions and letters to the editor. Oh, hell. But that's a different story. That's not the West. Mm-hmm. The newspapers of Texas, they were very blatant. They were very regional. They were also, well, Texas dreamed then and now as though they had a huge crime problem, and their overreaction in the papers was amazing. And of all the people killed in the last year, put to death by death sentences, approximately half were in Texas. And the newspapers support that. And that interests the historians. What's going on in their minds? And they divide themselves very quickly into those who believe in the death penalty and those who do not. All of the Western states used the death penalty. One of the last lynchings in the American West was at Price, Utah, yeah, in 1925. And so that kind of thing, it's interesting to read the justifications for what you do in the newspapers, including the defense of the vigilantes in Montana. Very interesting. Okay.
Sean, are you going to ask a question?
Sean?
Never mind. I'll ask it later.
Well, I want to hear. Who was, you know, I just remind my note, in 1905, there was the 11 millionaires in the state of Utah. I kind of surmise who said
1900.
So who was the one Mormon? There's the other 10.
No, there were 10. There were 11 millionaires, 10 of whom were non-Mormon.
Non-Mormon. Got it. So I think I kind of know who's the one that was a Mormon. Who was the one that was the Mormon millionaire? If you know, I don't know. We can pick out some of the other McCarthy's.
Let's see.
If you remember.
Brigham Young had died.
What?
I say Brigham Young had died.
Yeah, Brigham Young was a millionaire a couple of times over, but I'm trying to think of his name. Jesse Knight.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, just more out of curiosity.
A Mormon in mining, by the way.
Yeah, still in.
Yeah. In Corolla. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you know that,
yeah? Yeah, sure.
Do you know about Jesse Knight?
Uh-uh.
He was an interesting dude. Shall I depart?
Yes, you interesting dude, you.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Very, very fascinating.
I thought that was wonderful.
Thank you.
I just think it was.
It's just a few observations.
It is. Thank you so much.
Good luck to all of you.
We need it. Okay?
Thank you.
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's what an education's all about, it seems to me. Listening, and then we'll do what you recommend, which is talk a bit about it.
Do folks need a break? Do you want to take a couple minutes just as a stretch? Okay, there's, if you want to catch a drink or something like that, meaning carbonated or whatever, there are machines just around the way this way. And then what we'll do is we will think about what we've just been listening to. Great. Thank you. Oh, there you go. Oh.
Good stuff.
That was great. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Dr.
You just Google him.
So, I hope that wasn't an imposition. So excited. What were you going to ask?
Did you have trouble? And I probably told you
the one. There was one that I could check out.
Right. So you just went to the reserve desk.
Well,
good.
Because
I didn't say
anything or something like that. No, they could not find the ones that were supposed to be on reserve, and they thought maybe they were at another desk. And so I just said, okay. And they said, you got it for 7 days. And it's like, okay.
Good. So you were able to watch it?
Yes.
Were you able to watch it?
Yes.
You were able to watch it? And probably didn't need to watch it.
No, but I wrote it down. I would love to.
It's
it.
Fabulous. Oh, I got two copies.
Well,
I ordered two from Amazon, and I got three.
Yeah. Oh, it's...
I'm sorry I said the word Amazon, but they were the source for this. That was perfect. And I ended up watching it today as well, just as a review, and did find it fascinating. So we'll wait till Jeff comes back. Yeah. Just great. And I'm going to sort of turn my chair around here because I'm just determined to explore this idea of the constructed environment. And I thought Dr. O'Neill really got us thinking about a bunch of these things in terms of whose perspective, whose construction, and also his own construction. He's, he's knowledgeable and... I mean, I would come into his lectures. It was really neat. Let me stop this at this point, because I knew what I was getting in for. I knew I couldn't take my notes fast enough, and that it was wiser to just